like gold.
Gold.
Don't you dare put that in the podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Time and Attention. I am the co-host of this show, along with Arden. Hello.
Gaily today.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah,
folks.
Yeah. We've had our green tea. This is episode 1, 2, 3, Leveraged Productivity.
I still don't really know what this means. So this will be a fun episode where you have to try to walk me through something.
Okay.
That you're also trying to walk the audience through.
I'm trying to walk myself through this idea a little bit because this has been on my mind for a little while. And so I figured, what better place than a podcast to think through this idea with you,
what could go wrong?
Arden Nordstrom, wife of mine.
That is me.
Big shot over there.
I don't know about that.
Across the table.
Right now, I just feel giggly.
All right.
So, big shot.
Giggly wife, I have a question for you.
Yes.
So, that question. For every minute you spend on a task in your work, how much do you accomplish?
Depends on the minute.
Oh, yes. It depends on the task.
Yeah.
So this is something.
Did I get it right?
Yeah.
Ding,
well,
ding,
you
ding.
Said depends on the minute. I have written here, it depends on the task.
Well, that's the same thing because every minute I'm spending on different things.
Yeah. I don't want to get Mr. Technical on you. But I'll reward you 0.75 out of 1
that
for
is
that answer.
Bogus.
So this is something that is fascinating about productivity, especially, and we're looking at work, like it in a work context, but not all tasks are created equal. So the tasks in our work vary depending on how much kind of they provide us with for every unit of time. And so the more that we're able to accomplish through a task, the more leverage essentially we have over our time. And so it's in this way that there are high leverage tasks where we accomplish an inordinate amount for every minute that we spend on them. And there are low leverage tasks where we accomplish basically nothing for every minute that we spend on them. So a high leverage task might be, you know, think of the things that are most core to the work that you do. Mentoring a new employee that joins your team. For every minute you spend with that employee, you might make that time back 100-fold because they're able to contribute so much more to your organization. Hunkering down on writing some report that's integral for your most important client or customer. We all have these tasks that are the core of what we do, where we accomplish an inordinate amount through them. And then we have kind of the stuff on the other side of the spectrum, right? If we spend, you know, one more minute rereading our email inbox when nothing new came in because we don't have enough energy to do something else. On a personal level, you know, there are these folks who like to refresh investments every like 2 minutes, see how they're doing throughout the day, even though these are like retirement investments that, you know, will be choppy until the day that you retire. Watching Netflix, you know, at work. It might be a low leverage, even though it's not really related to work. But I think you get the idea, right?
Yeah.
There are certain things that are high leverage and low leverage.
Is that the same as high value and low value?
Yeah.
Because it sounds like the same thing, right? Where I know that if I spend time on my revise and resubmit, which is a big part of like the publication process, that's a really high value activity for me because mm-hmm. I need publications to get tenure.
Yeah.
And so if I work on that R&R, that's a great thing for you.
Nobody
to use
knows
my time.
What
I revise
R&R
and resubmit.
Okay.
I said it before,
okay.
But I didn't spell out the acronym. Sorry,
okay.
Folks. R&R equals revise
You're
and resubmit.
You're confusing me over here. No,
but that's a really high value use of my time.
Yeah.
On the other side, I mean, I think I'm pretty good at not accumulating things that have low value.
Yeah. Well, that's a big part of productivity is defending your time against things that have no value.
Yeah. I actually started a no list of things I say no to because I think that's worth remembering.
Why does it
all
say
of the things.
Christopher on the top?
No. That, well, I guess I just did say no. But all that to say, I do have a list of...
Oh, you just said no. Okay, yeah, yeah.
I do have a list of things that I say no to just to kind of almost to make a point of acknowledging that that's an important thing to do. So I don't share this list with anybody, but yeah. It's a list I have because I think it's important to say no to stuff that's low value. Like if you're invited, so if I'm invited to an event that has nothing to do with my research, it's not a good opportunity to meet people or network or support my students or anything like that. Like, of course I should say no. Like if there's no value in me going. Mm-hmm. And so I've started saying no to things that are not a good use of my time or yeah. things like that. Or like being asked to teach an extra class in a different university or something like that, which is not really a good use of my time right now as I need to get tenure. So yeah. those are all things that wouldn't have a lot of value. So I think I'm pretty good at saying no to stuff, but yeah, of course there are things that just don't add quite as much value, like answering emails and things. Mm-hmm. Some emails are valuable, but some are less.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of thinking with this idea about where leverage is going with our time. And so if you look at for every unit of our time, how much we're able to accomplish, that has increased over time. Right. This is a simple kind of probably not simple, a function of economic productivity. Right. The more that we're able to contribute with a day of our time, the more productive we are as individuals. And the more we're all able to contribute with a day of our time, the more productive we all become. Personal productivity is my jam. I don't know as much about economic productivity, but there is that relationship between them. And over time, our leverage goes up as, in terms of how much we're able to accomplish with every unit of time, largely because of technological progression. Would you agree? You're an economist, a professional economist. How is my
Yeah, I don't want to go through there. Like all of the growth, economic growth models, because okay. that's just a really long...
Nobody wants that.
That's
either.
A huge literature. If you really want to read about that, yeah. go ahead. But that's not what we're doing here. No, I think you're totally right that we, like, as individuals, technology can improve our work, right? Yeah. We saw that 30 years ago with the invention of the internet, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine working your day-to-day job right now without the internet, right? It would be really, really hard. And 50 years ago, it was the computer. And so there have always been technologies that enter our lives, and that's fine. That's a totally normal thing. And our jobs adapt accordingly, right? If you had to write a letter for every email you send, imagine how cumbersome that would be, right? We have email now. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are other consequences of how easy that is, but all that to say, like there is technology and they can affect us individually to help affect how we do our daily work and where the value comes from that work.
And computers and software programming, I think are really fascinating example of how we're able to rise up through these different layers of leverage is how I've kind of been thinking about them over time. So as new technology, and I'm thinking about this in the context of AI technology, which we'll talk about in a little bit here. But over time, especially like software programming, think of software programming. So when you code in a programming language and your code runs, mm-hmm. Hopefully this is accessible for people who don't know anything about programming languages. So you code something in a programming language and you run your code. It goes through a bunch of steps mm-hmm. to eventually become ones and zeros, basically on or off states on the chips inside of your computer. At a tiny, tiny microscopic level, everything tumbles down into ones and zeros. And it used to be, when programming first came along, that we had to do, we had to code in machine language. And so we were actually coding in ones and zeros, mm-hmm. in literal ones and zeros. You know, look at a punch card system, which are ones and zeros on paper. Mm-hmm. You know, we were coding in machine language. And that's not to say you couldn't make something great with that machine language. Roller Coaster Tycoon, the original game. was programmed in machine language.
No way.
If you've ever played that game, you will think the person who made it, Chris Sawyer, is a genius. And I would agree with you. But luckily for those of us who are not Chris Sawyer, which is everybody except for Chris Sawyer, programming languages quickly came along after this point. So instead of using ones and zeros, we can write in something that looked more like a sentence, right? It didn't look, obviously, completely like a sentence.
It has its own syntax.
It has syntax, brackets, there's square brackets, round brackets, code words, semicolons, oh my. But we can write in kind of a more natural and readable way, which the computer would then take what we wrote, translate that into ones and zeros. So we kind of rose up a layer. We rose up a layer of leverage, and we saved a lot of time because of that technological progress. And so we were able to accomplish more coding in these more natural language programming languages than this machine code that, you know, you needed a lot of sophisticated understanding to work with. And then we rose up another layer, right? We have APIs now, which are essentially features of a system that developers can access. And so think of an app on your phone. So if somebody wants to code an app on your phone, think of the simplest app. Just a big screen where when you press it, your flashlight turns on. That is literally one line of code. It doesn't take thousands of lines of code to communicate with the system to turn the flashlight on. It's one line. And so we rose up another layer with APIs. And now we're rising up another layer in software programming where we're gaining even more leverage over our time with tools like GitHub Copilot, which essentially is autocomplete, but for code, I believe it's positioned as. So you type a little bit and then it will autocomplete that for you and save you an inordinate amount of time in the process. And so we rise up another layer still. And, you know, the other day I was thinking, it would be great. I have this Mac computer. It would be great if I just had a little script that automatically ran 1 hour after I plugged in a specific external hard drive to eject that disk. And so I asked ChatGPT, and it programmed it for me. And that feels like another layer still, you know, of programming, where the ultimate layer is to not need to program at all. And so these layers of leverage, we rise up over time, largely because of technological progression. And there's a new layer for many of us on the way because of AI.
Okay. So I think there's a lot to unpack there.
Sorry. was that too much?
No.
I think buffer overflow.
No, I'll add a couple of examples. So I actually do code in my day-to-day work. I don't do like software development kind of coding. I do mostly like statistical analysis.
Machine learning, statistics.
Stuff. Yeah, that realm of analysis.
Yeah.
But it's all really focused on trying to understand patterns in data because that's what I do for a living. I try to figure out how projects work and how programs are affecting different outcomes for folks all around the world on like education projects and things like that. So I do, and I have had this thought many, many times, that I am so happy I don't have to run, if I'm doing like a regression, for example, which is like a fairly simple tool in statistics, that I don't have to code that in ones and zeros.
Yeah.
I had a professor in my PhD who had done his PhD probably in the, I want to say the 60s or the 70s. And he actually did have to run regressions using punch cards. So he had to take all these punch cards, book a computer, because the university, I don't remember where he went, Princeton? I think Princeton. But the university had like one super computer thing and you had to book time. And if you screwed up your punch cards ahead of time, you didn't get results. Like it would, And I think about that now. Like if I forget a comma in my code, I mostly program in R and Python, but and you can use other tools like Stata and things like that too for this kind of work. I think about this all the time. Like if I screw up a comma, there's almost no cost, right? It's mm-hmm. annoying. And if I have code that takes like half an hour to run or even hours to run, that's annoying. But you should, and to avoid that, you should run individual increments to make sure they work individually and then run the whole thing. But all that to say, I mean, that would suck, right? Like that's a huge time use that I never have to worry about now. That said, though, I do think there's value in remembering that even if you are moving up what you're calling these like layers of abstraction.
Mm-hmm. That's what it's called in programming. Yeah. I think in this context, layers of leverage might make more sense, but layers of abstraction also.
Or value. Like, right, this is, I don't have to code in ones and zeros, so I don't have to waste all that time. Like, I can move to other things, which means I can work with bigger data sets, right? I'm not manually punching out data in cards. And so I can spend more time thinking about what we can learn from that data, right? I don't have to spend time punching out cards. I can spend time collecting maybe more data or analyzing it in a new way that allows us to represent these relationships more in a more complex way, right? And before, if you're just doing a simple linear regression, you're making a lot of assumptions about what those relationships look like. I don't have to be limited to those assumptions because I only have one computer and punch cards. Mm-hmm. I can work with new tools that allow me to analyze a lot more data in much more sophisticated ways because we have these new technologies. So I think that is like in my work, I very clearly see like where these technologies make my work easier, which allow me to focus on bigger or more complex problems. And that's true across all fields, right? Yeah. All of these other fields are experiencing that in research and not just in academia, outside of academia as well. But I did want to highlight the fact that, yes, even if you're moving up these layers of abstraction, all of those underlying things are still happening, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so it's important. And I think one thing I think about a lot with, especially with things like AI and ChatGPT and all these other tools that are out there now.
There's a lot of them now.
Yeah, and even with things, I mean, this has been true forever, where if you don't really understand what's going on in those lower levels, you can open yourself up to a lot of challenges, right? And so I use R as an example here. If you don't know what's going on in the package that it takes, it might take you one line to run a really complicated machine learning algorithm. And that's great. Somebody built you a really great package that allows you to not fiddle with all of these many, many lines of code to make sure every step in the algorithm is correct. That's wonderful. That's very helpful. And it can save me a lot of time, but it's making the assumption that all those underlying levels are right and that you understand what's going on there. And so
you don't want to be standing on shaky ground.
No. And I worry about, especially with some of the output you get from ChatGPT, it just tells you, oh, you should do this thing. And it definitely is at a higher level and I'm very grateful. Like I have the technical skills. So I use ChatGPT, for example, quite a lot when I'm working with kind of how I represent the graphs and visuals of the output of my models and things like that.
In terms of cleaning data and
not
stuff?
Even not cleaning the data, just literally like getting tables into nice graphs because that stuff just is so fiddly. And I used to spend so much time just getting the tables and the like regression output out of R in a nice way. And in a way that is like every time I re-updated it, there's like a nice workflow. That just takes a lot of time to set up. And ChatGPT has just been amazing in taking things that used to take me like quite frankly hours or days in like a few minutes.
And that's awesome.
Kind of amazing. This is stuff that I still know like how to do it. So I can understand if it's giving me something that is going to misconstrue what I'm trying to accomplish. Which I think is really important that we have to be like informed users of what that next level of value actually is, right? Mm-hmm. Where I can say, I hate spending 2 days setting up like a way to get my regression output out of R and into whatever word processing tool I'm using in a way that's visually quite aesthetic and making sure like the tables and figures in my papers are nice and well formatted and clear and like, I know how to do those things, but I don't want to spend 2 days doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really good example of where I've been able to use ChatGPT and stop wasting time on something that is, quite frankly, like, that's a part of the project. But the main project, like the thing that really is where I bring value, is thinking about what we're learning from those findings, right? Mm. Not making them pretty, is really thinking about how, what are we learning from this?
Yeah.
And so I can focus on asking those questions instead of, oh my gosh, where do I put this comma?
Yeah.
Which is just not quite as valuable. And so, I mean, I think the example of like going from punch cards 60 years ago where, and this is one of the like most productive and prolific professors I've ever known.
Oh yeah, I know who you're talking about.
And
yeah.
he's so, so productive and so insightful and so thoughtful. And he's
brilliant.
Just brilliant. Yeah. And I'm so grateful I got to work with and learning about his experience with like these older technologies. Like, I think just it's amazing that we've come so far in like such a short amount of time. And that's freed up the opportunity to ask like bigger questions, different questions, which is amazing for research.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we need to make sure we still know what's under the hood.
Yeah.
And so I think that's I know that wasn't the focus of this episode, but I think
this is
ChatGPT, I think especially, I see this all the time. Like, I've seen this even before ChatGPT, people would just use packages unthinkingly and then months into their analysis realize, oh, I didn't know that's how this algorithm was working.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so dangerous, right?
Yeah.
If you're doing some kind of analysis and you don't know how it's working, you should be very, very concerned about what you're learning. So
yeah.
I think it's helpful to just remember that even if you're moving up these layers of abstraction or layers of value or leverage or whatever you want to call it, making sure you understand what's going on underneath is still really important.
Oh, I'm so happy you made that point. And well put too. Looking at kind of the other places that we have risen up layers of abstraction before AI even, that understanding of the kind of foundational layers for where we are is so critical. Like, if you look at project management software, which I'm sure every project manager, including those that listen to the pod, is happy that this exists because, you know, you don't have to reach out to everybody for status updates and things. It happens automatically. But understanding how those status updates fit into the broader mm-hmm. picture of the project, it can lead you to run a better project if you have the understanding of the foundational layers. Healthcare systems, you know, healthcare record keeping, has allowed a lot of people in healthcare to rise up layers of abstraction. It eliminates these organizational headaches that used to happen, but you need to understand the patient and what you're actually organizing. And so maybe it adds clarity there. And cleaning up data, is another way that I think a lot of us have risen up, including cleaning up data through things like ChatGPT. But if you don't really have that foundational understanding of what you're cleaning up and if it's making mistakes, if it's doing things that you don't necessarily want it to do. I think the more blind spots you have with artificial intelligence, the more opportunity there is for it to go somewhere where you don't want it to go. So I guess it's kind of like a two-part, isn't it? It's understanding what it's doing. And there will come a point where artificial intelligence eclipses our understanding of what it's doing. But understanding all that we can about what it's doing, while using it and kind of holding hands with that technology so that we can rise up the layers of abstraction with it. Kind of that understanding and rising up is, kind of the two-parter. I like that you made that point.
Yeah.
So how do we rise up then? I think looking at this from that productivity vantage point, that personal productivity vantage point, where every day, you know, in any moment, there are 1,000 things that we could be doing. Like, when you get to work, and maybe you're at work, maybe this is a break or something, but the next moment that you're working and deciding what to do, there are a limitless number of things that you could be doing in that moment. It's kind of like when you fire up Netflix and there's a grid that goes on for miles of what you could be watching and how you could feel and what you could essentially get out of your time. And work is the same way, where there are the things that are obvious to do. There are the things that are pressing to do. There are the things that are our highest leverage tasks that are the most truly important to do. There are the things that we could be learning. There's the new things that we could be doing as well with these AI technologies. And I don't think the promise of AI is anywhere near where it will be quite soon. But I think kind of keeping an eye on what opportunities exist that give us more leverage over our time, that allow us to save time, that add value to what we do and allow us to accomplish more, things we can delegate to an AI to do. I think these are kind of areas that we can look at that are promising for finding those highest leverage things that we could be doing throughout our day.
Yeah. And I think you use the word delegate there because this isn't just specific to AI, right?
Yeah.
I mean, moving up, making sure we're focusing on the things that really add value or are like the best uses of our time doesn't require just using AI, right? Yeah. Maybe that's, oh, realizing you're wasting a lot of time spending. I mean, I think Laura Vanderkam actually does a good example of talking about how, like, you if you realize that you could pay for like a cleaning service or something, or and that's a really specific example, but that's an area where if you're wasting a lot of time cleaning your house and you could hire somebody who's much better at that than you are, you could focus on things that may be more specific to what you want to accomplish. And that's just one example. And that's a more like physical example. I just wanted to highlight that this isn't just specific to AI, but AI is obviously a huge opportunity here where there's so much we can kind of rethink in how we'd structure our work. Mm-hmm. Especially if we're doing kind of technical work, there's lots of opportunity there. Yeah. Recognizing the downsides.
This was an interesting report to sift through. So desk time. Have you heard of desk time?
Only through you.
They essentially, it's a time tracking app, and they look at what their most productive users do. They look at how many breaks people take. They're the source for a lot of the interesting research on breaks. But they just came out with a new report on how we use AI technology at work. In 2023, Americans spent 93 hours on average using AI-driven technologies. And so, you know, I think starting kind of with these might be interesting. So let's go down the list.
Sure.
Canva. Have you used Canva?
Not personally, but lots of my students use it for presentations.
Making things look good. It's amazing. Updates.
These presentations are just beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a joy to see presentations made with Canva.
Oh.
Yeah.
Rising up a layer. Your students.
It's amazing. I learned so much from my students. It's beautiful.
Number two, ChatGPT.
Yeah, I do use it.
You heard of that?
I don't use it for writing because I think that's a tricky area to navigate in I think I still believe that good researchers can bring more to the table than ChatGPT can. I mean, if you ask it for really technical stuff, you see that very quickly. Where it can make things sound beautiful, but it can be very inaccurate or just kind of fluffy and nonspecific. I don't use it really for writing at all, but I do use it for code. Absolutely. Because it is such a good way to get rid of tasks that are not where I bring a lot of value.
I don't use it to write at all. And I don't want to make a blanket statement, but I can't foresee a time when I will use it to write. But obviously things shift, but I have this just natural aversion to using it to write anything on my behalf because I want my own voice, my own weird, quirky voice to come through in what I create. I mostly use it to kind of find blind spots with ideas, to think through ideas. I find their virtual assistant really good too. Bing, number three.
Yeah, I don't use that.
Number four, GitHub. GitHub Copilot. That's what
I haven't actually used this. I feel like I should, but I just haven't explored that.
Some of these are more technical. DeepL. I had never heard of this one. It's a translator app.
Yeah, that's cool.
DEEPL. And they market themselves as being more accurate than kind of Google Translate and things like that. Google Chrome, Amazon AWS, Shopify, the App Store, Hugging Face, yeah, which is a machine learning, yep, kind of repository, Google Workspace, and Tiny Wow.
Yeah, Tiny Wow seems so cool.
Yeah, it's all these like kind of tinywow.com, all these free tools that where you can write paragraphs, do things with video, writing, images, PDFs,
yeah,
and other files as well. So I think kind of keeping an eye on what AI technology is out there. These are, you know, I think we'll look back on apps like these as kind of the starting point.
Well, look at this like we look at MySpace now.
Yeah. remember when they used to hallucinate these apps? Yeah. That's what we'll be saying. But so, you know, I think looking for things that we can delegate tasks to like those, especially with file management, PDF management, that sort of thing,
yeah,
these tools can help. Looking for ways that they can save us time. I think this is kind of where we're at right now. Fleshing out our ideas with them to find blind spots, to think about ways that different ideas can be interpreted by others. I also use that for ChatGPT. And yeah, just, you know, finding all the opportunities that we can to spend more time on the highest possible leverage things that we can. For every unit of time, every task is different for what it provides us with in terms of how much happiness it provides us with, how much meaning it provides us with, how much productivity it provides us with in that work context. And always be keeping that in mind. You know, when the moment comes to do the next thing after you're done the current thing, after you listen to this pod, think of the Netflix grid. Right? think of all the options before you. For all the productive things, all the meaningful things, there's an infinite number of things, but look for opportunities to rise up through those layers of abstraction and to understand what's happening along the way.
Love it.
Timeandattention.fm is where you can find all the corresponding show notes for this episode of the pod. We'll see you in a couple Tuesdays.
Bye.